all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type, United States Army, 1969, helicopter pilot, Vietnam, 195th Assault Helicopter Company. I mention that today because we're going to be talking with aviators. I'm really excited about today's program. I wanted to make sure everybody is aware of what we're going to be doing. On December 7th of this year, unfortunately, we lost a world-famous aviator, and that was Chuck Yeager, the man faster than the speed of sound, the first one to go faster than the speed of sound. And so we're going to pay homage to him today, not only with an interview that we did 12 years ago now. My partner Ken Rogge did an interview with Chuck Yeager. He's talking about the P-51 fighter airplane that was used mostly during World War II. And so we're going to play that in just a moment. And then after that, we're going to have on another P-51 pilot, probably one of the best P-51 pilots in the world, according to Chuck Yeager, and that is Bud Anderson. And so we've got the interview with Chuck runs about close to 20 minutes. But before we get into that right now, I want to make sure that we want to thank all of our wonderful sponsors. Without you, we would never be able to be here, not only on this station, but the station that you may be listening to us on today. I want to thank Legal Help for Veterans, the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, the Eisenhower Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, VetBiz Central, and, of course, our local veteran service organizations. We've got the American Legion Post 46, Veterans of Foreign War Post 423, and the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Post number 310. And I mentioned Charles S. Kettles because there's breaking news coming out that the Ann Arbor Veterans Administration Hospital is going to be renamed the Charles S. Kettles Veterans Administration Hospital very shortly. And so we're very proud of that, and we're very proud that we had the privilege of knowing Chuck. For those of you that are not familiar, Chuck received his Medal of Honor for action in Vietnam in 1967, I think it was 66, 67 now, where he went back into an LZ more than once and eventually saved the lives of 41 people. You can find him on our website. To learn more about all of our sponsors and organizations that are helping us out here, you can go to our website. That's veteransradio.net/sponsors. Also, if you want to know more about Chuck Yeager or Charlie Kettles, you can go to our website and into the search for thing up there in the corner. You just type in the name and it'll bring up any programs that they were on during the 17 years we've been on Veterans Radio. Wow, 17 years is a long time. I want to get right into the interview with Chuck Yeager right now. As I mentioned, this was done in July of 2007. My partner Ken Rogge did the interview. And so, Derek, whenever you're ready, here you go.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and our first guest needs little introduction. He's retired Air Force Brigadier General Chuck Yeager. He's had a remarkable career. He was a double ace and was shot down in World War II, and went on to be the first man to break the sound barrier and had a highly successful Air Force career. But we're not here to talk about his life today. We're talking about the P-51 Mustang. And I spoke with Chuck Yeager last night and recorded our conversation. In your bio, it talks about a Malcolm's hood. What is a Malcolm's hood?
Oh, you mean a Malcolm? Well, actually, the first P-51s that were built had a birdcage canopy on it, we called it. And basically, the birdcage canopy, was small squares of plexiglass, and visibility wasn't too good. So they put a Malcolm hood canopy on it. And all it did was kind of round it out and make a bubble, but it really wasn't as good as the P-51D that finally came out with a birdcage canopy, or with a canopy on it that was streamlined, big, teardrop shape, and it was beautiful.
Uh-huh. During your training, you flew the P-39. What was it like to go from the P-39 to a P-51?
Well, actually, it wasn't bad. The P-39, of course, is a tricycle gear airplane, and basically, we'd flown tail draggers in primary and basic and advanced, the T-6s, which we flew when we graduated and got our wings. Then when we got back into the P-51, it wasn't very difficult to fly a tail dragger again, since we'd already been trained in tail draggers. Mm-hmm. So the thing was, it was really a very powerful airplane with that with the Packard-built Merlin engine in it. And let me make one thing real clear to you. There's never an American P-51 with a Rolls-Royce engine in it.
There wasn't?
It was always a Packard-built Merlin engine made in the United States.
Oh, I was under the impression they had Rolls-Royces in them.
No, Rolls-Royce designed the Merlin engine, but the United States got the license to build them. And the Packard Motor Car Company built all of those Packard Merlins, and also a few Continental Merlins were built by Continental Motor Company.
Wait, how powerful was that engine?
About 1,600 horsepower. But the main thing that made it wonderful was it had a two-stage blower in it, a low blower and a high blower. And with the high blower, you could get almost as much horsepower of the engine at 35,000 feet that you got at sea level.
Was that like a turbocharger?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, blower. We call them blowers.
Okay. The Mustang, was that the first plane with a four-bladed prop?
No. It never didn't make much difference. A lot of airplanes, like first Mustangs, had three-bladed props on the ones that had the Allison engine.
And what was your first impression of the Mustang, the first time you saw it?
Well, it's a pretty airplane, and basically when we flew it, what happened was in 1942 and 43, the bombers were escorted by P-38s and P-47s. And I hate to say this, but the Germans shot down just about every P-38 in the theater. I mean, really clobbered them, because they couldn't outrun or outclimb or outdive the 109s and 190s. So basically, they only had 4 hours of fuel. So they stay with the bombers for two hours, turn around, and come home. Well, the bombers were, you know, only about two-thirds of the way to the target by then. So when the escort left, the Germans went in and really started hammering the guys. And then, but when the Mustang came over, it had additional fuel tanks in it, and consequently, and also was heavier, and it had 8 hours of endurance.
Mm-hmm.
We flew many 8-hour missions. That meant we could stay with the bombers all the way to the target and back.
How much transition training did you have to go through?
None. We picked up the P-51, we got to England in November of 43, and they put us at a base down called, Radenwood, which was nothing but a mud hole, and that was in 9th Air Force. Well, they wanted the Mustangs in 8th Air Force, because 8th Air Force was what was doing the long-range bombing.
Right.
9th Air Force was a tactical air force, you know, just around France and places like that. So consequently, what we did, we went up to where they were assembling the airplane, and a sergeant showed you how to start it. You didn't have any books, but basically, airplanes are a lot like cars. You know, you learn one car, not too difficult to learn another car.
Uh-huh.
So consequently, when the guy showed us how to start, I reckon there's about 12 of us picked up the first bunch and flew back to our base down at Leiston. And then the next day, we're sitting over Leipzig, Germany, fighting in them.
That's a big transition
there. That's just the way it was, you know. And some of the funny things, And if you're a pilot, you'll understand this. In the P-39, when we flew instruments, we used a needle ball airspeed, otherwise to fly instruments with. Mm-hmm. There was no flight indicator, which we call. And that's the way we flew instruments in the P-39, was flying the needle and the ball and airspeed. Hell, if the airspeed started building up, you knew the nose was down. And if it didn't change, you knew you were level. And consequently, when we took off the next day after picking up the P-51s, it was about, I don't know, probably 32 or so Mustangs. And we were sitting over Leipzig, Germany, escorting bombers in them the second flight. Mm-hmm. And consequently, about five days later, or about five missions later, one of the guys, we're sitting in a Nissan up talking, and he said, "Hey, you know, there's an instrument in the instrument panel on the P-51. Said, if you uncage it, it stays level with the ground." And we said, "Oh, you're kidding." He said, "So when next time we flew it, yeah, there's a so-called flight indicator, but you got to turn it on, and it stays level with the ground, regardless which way you turn the airplane," and made it easy to fly instruments. But that's the way we learned, you know.
Yeah. What made the Mustang so special?
Well, everything I've said up until now. Obviously, 8 hours, had 650 caliber machine guns. Each gun fired around 850 rounds a minute. And you carried about almost 2,400 rounds of ammunition. That's almost 30 seconds of firepower in your airplane. And, of course, you never used over about 3-second bursts because you burned your barrels out. And that plus 8 hours of endurance, plus a top speed of 430 miles an hour, that we could outrun, outdive, and outclimb all the 109s or 190s. And that's the reason it was so special. And you know, it was a hell of an airplane. When the Germans, like I shot down my first airplane over Berlin, well, when the Germans saw Mustangs over Berlin, they say, old Goring said, "Man, we've lost the war." Because and also, a couple missions, we went from England to Russia and landed in Russia and stayed there for a week and then flew from Russia to Brindisi, Italy.
Uh-huh.
Hell, you're talking about 2,400 miles.
That's a long way.
Yeah, that's a long way. And also, being so fast, and we flew most of the missions when we were escorting about 36,000 feet.
Your bio says you flew the B, C, and D models. Why did you wind up flying all three? Were they shot down?
Well, that's the way they were produced.
Oh, I see.
See, the B had the birdcage canopy. It was as fast as a D was. But then when we got the teardrop canopy on the Ds, and also there's a couple of other improvements. One was a lead computing gun sight on the D.
Mm-hmm.
That made it very easy to, this gun sight made it possible for you to compute lead. All you had to do is put the pipper on the enemy airplane and range the little diamonds on its wingtip, and it would compute the proper lead. And once you got it settled in, you pull the trigger and you blew a hole right through the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we got G suits in the D. And when the G suits came, you know, it gave us, we compressed our G-suits, gave us capability of pulling about six Gs or seven Gs, which was the max that the airplane would pull before it broke up. You could pull six Gs without blacking out. And without a G-suit, you black out at about four Gs.
Right.
Those things, you know, Germans never did get G-suits, and it gave us a hell of a... Yeah. Now, the Mustangs... As I said before, the P-38s weren't, you get arguments about guys who flew P-38s would argue with you, but hell, they didn't last very long over there. But when they sent them to the Pacific, the P-38 was a low-altitude fighter. It had an Allison engine in it with a turbo supercharger. But the thing was, it could outrun and outclimb and outdive the Zero.
Uh-huh.
So the Zero couldn't catch it. It could not get away from the German fighters, which were faster and could turn better. And consequently, they did real well in the Pacific. And basically, the Mustang shot down more airplanes than any other fighter in World War II.
That's
and it's over 5,000 German fighters. And they finally put them in the Pacific later on. See, there were no Marines, no Navy in Europe.
Uh-huh.
They were all Air Force and Army.
Right.
And the Marines and Navy was in the Pacific. And they gradually, as the war wound down in the summer of 45, they moved some P-51 units into the Pacific and used them to escort B-29s, whereas theretofore the Navy fighters couldn't get high enough or go fast enough to escort B-29. They flew off carriers and did a lot of battleship damage.
You were shot down on your eighth mission. What happened? How did
God shot me down?
How did he do that?
Well, basically, I was flying tail end Charlie. I'd taken off as spare, like if you have 16 airplanes in your squadron, you have four flights of finger four, you call them,
mm-hmm.
which is, it splits up into two elements when you get into a fight. And I took off as spare, and a guy boarded, and I filled in as number four, and we were going down to southern France to hit some Fokker 190 plants or airfield, and consequently, I called in. We got jumped by three Fokker 190s, and I picked them up coming in from high at 6 o'clock, and I called them in, and we all broke back into them. I made a head-on pass with them, and two or three were shooting at me, and I'd start shooting too, and I got hit with a bunch of 20-millimeter cannon, took the prop off, and the engine part of the left wing, and the airplane just fell apart around me, and I come down and open my parachute, and then overran around France for a couple of days until I contacted a woodcutter. We'd always been warned about, on survival and evasion, to only fool with very poor people. And, I went up to this woodcutter. He didn't speak English, and I didn't speak French, and he realized I was I had a few holes in me, in my legs and fragments of 20 millimeters in my hand. But basically in my survival kit that we carried in our flying suit pocket, we had sulfur powder. Do you know what sulfur powder is?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay. Well, I sprinkled sulfur powder on my wounds and wrapped my legs with some parachutes so I never did get infected. And then when I contacted this woodcutter, and he was gone about 3 hours, and he came back with a guy that spoke English and said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to get to Spain, which is a neutral country. See, in Europe, there were three neutral countries, Spain, Switzerland, and Sweden.
Uh-huh.
And if you got into a neutral country, then you were interned, and usually the American consulate picked you out of jail and put you up in a hotel, gave you money and stuff like that. And it's pretty soft life. And, well, I ran around with the French Mackie, the Free Frenchman,
uh-huh.
underground.
Yes.
For about 2 months or a month and a half. And I stayed with them, traveled with them. And I didn't go out on the raids, but the British would drop canisters in parachutes at night on. They had radios that they communicate with England, and they'd drop these parachutes had plastic explosives and counterfeit money, counterfeit bread and meat ration stamps and guns and all of this stuff, and they were pretty well armed, and they did a lot of damage to the Germans and blowing up railroad tracks and bridges and things like that. And I'll tell you something. A lot of Americans don't realize the French saved thousands and thousands of American airmen's lives. And I owe my neck to them. And, boy, I'll tell you, when some guy starts bad-mouthing France, that's fighting words to me. It's too damn bad. The press doesn't, give them credit for what they did. And it was something. But anyway, I spent a couple of months in Spain is really, you know, it's really soft, like living in a hotel and swimming, eating good, and money and all that stuff. And it was the United States. See, Spain had no access to petroleum products, so the United States started negotiating with Spain for us fighter pilots that were interned in Spain, and said, "We'll give you gasoline for the pilots." Hell, I don't know how many gallons we were worth, but they negotiated and traded gasoline to Spain, and then Spaniards turned us over to the British at Gibraltar, and they flew us back to England. I went back to my squadron after D-Day, and then started flew 50 more missions, and shot down a total of a dozen Germans, 12 and a half, and it was I enjoyed it, and then I came home, and that was the end of the Mustangs. The D's we flew when I got back, man, I really loved them. They were one fine airplane, and our mechanics were guys that were good in maintenance, and they were also, when I come home, I thought I was 22 years old. Well, the crew chiefs and the maintenance guys were about 10 years older than we were.
Uh-huh.
The pilots were young and the maintenance guys were older, and they sort of looked at us like their sons, and they were, it'd really get to them when one of the guys wouldn't come back.
Well, General, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Veterans Radio. It's been an honor, and I wish you good luck.
Hey, I want to put Victoria on for a second, give you our website. We have a foundation that we support kids in education.
Uh-huh.
It's really good, and I'll put it on. She can give it to you, and then it's been fun talking to you.
I enjoyed it, sir. Thank you very much.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wanted to just tell you about our website, chuckyeager.com, for people who wanted to find out more about General Yeager and also about the General Chuck Yeager Foundation. We support Marshall University's Yeager Scholars, which is a 4-year full scholarship program, semester abroad, summer at Oxford, as well as Air Academy, which is a week of aviation instruction at Oshkosh, EAA, Experimental Aircraft Association, and as well as a few other things, including fish habitat, hunter education, even Down syndrome folks. And so it's quite a variety. General Yeager takes no administration costs out of the foundation at all.
Well, that's wonderful. Wonderful. And what is that website for the foundation?
www.chuckyeager.com.
Okay.
Chuckyeager.
Thank you, Victoria. It's a pleasure talking to you. And I want to thank the general very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Ken Rogge interviewing Chuck Yeager back in 2007. We're going to take a real quick break right now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with our guest for the day, who is Bud Anderson, who flew at the same time as Chuck Yeager. So we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be right back after these messages.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be joined by our guest for today's program, and that is going to be Bud Anderson. But before I get to Bud Anderson, I want to introduce a young lady to you who introduced me to Bud Anderson. And this happens to be a student of mine at Washtenaw Community College, and her name is Bernadette Remsky. And Bernadette, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hello, Dale. Thanks so much for inviting me here. I'm happy to join you guys.
Thank you very much. I wanted to introduce you to our audience because I realize that you are a military aviation fanatic, it seems like.
That is correct, yes.
And that you're going to be, at some point, it looks like you're going to be studying history. Is that true?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. Well, tell me how you met Bud.
Well, certainly. So I was privileged to meet Bud through, I guess you could say, two different interests of mine. The first one, of course, being history. I've always been fascinated by World War II history, and not only fascinated, but just humbled by the fact that so many men and women during that time made tremendous sacrifices for our freedoms and for our country. And my heart is filled with gratitude for those men and women and for everything that they did. And a second interest that led me to meeting Mr. Anderson is airplanes. I've always loved airplanes, and especially going to air shows and watching all the cool military planes and the B-2 bombers and the Blue Angels, and I love listening to them, too. I haven't been in one yet, but I hope to someday, and I've just always really enjoyed them. So one day, it was back in May, I was on the Internet, and I was reading about the P-51 Mustang, and I was looking at some really cool articles and some really neat pictures. And as I was scrolling through the pictures, I came across this photo of a handsome young fighter pilot, and he was sitting on the wing of a P-51 Mustang. And, of course, it was a picture of Mr. Anderson. So this led me to his website, where I read a little bit more about his story, and I learned that he was a triple ace from the 357th Fighter Group. And I was amazed by his story. And, of course, I was very happy when I found out that this incredible gentleman was still here with us today. So, naturally, I wanted to learn more, and I wanted to reach out. And, most importantly, I wanted to thank him for everything. So, through the website, I was able to contact Bud's son, Jim. And he kindly gave me his mailing address, and I wrote to Bud. And I also painted him a picture of his P-51 Mustang named Old Crow, and I sent them to him by mail. And shortly afterwards, he got back to me, and he said that he really liked the painting and that it was a great surprise. And in return, he sent me a copy of his awesome book, and he also sent me a copy of that very same picture that I first saw of him on the Internet, where he's sitting on the wing of the P-51 Mustang. So that's how I met Mr. Anderson, and I'm happy to say that we've been corresponding ever since.
Well, I'm very appreciative of you corresponding with him and putting me in touch with him. And I'm going to bring Bud on in just a second, but I just want to let people know what this young man did during World War II. It says here that in addition to flying the P-51 Mustang from November through January of 1945, flew over 116 combat missions or 480 hours, destroyed 16 and a quarter enemy aircraft in aerial combat and another one on the ground. He received five Distinguished Flying Crosses, 16 air medals. Chuck Yeager described Anderson as a mongoose. He said he was the best fighter pilot he'd ever seen. He talked about how calm and how what a gentleman Bud was on the ground, but get him in the air, and he was fierce. So I want to welcome him to our program right now. Clarence E., better known as Bud Anderson, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thank you, Dale.
Thank you very much. I wanted to point out that Bud is calling, we're talking to him from California, and Bud is 98 years old. And I also wanted to mention that Bernadette, who did the is here with us today for the interview, has a birthday coming up, and she's going to be all of 21. So happy birthday to Bernadette. So, Bud, tell me, how did you get involved in flying during World War II?
Well, I wanted to, it was a passion with me as a youngster, wanted to fly. I was lived on the farm, and, you know, we had a depression. There was no money for Bud Anderson to go fly airplanes, so I looked up the requirements for flying in to be 20 years old, you had to have 2 years of college, physically fit and unmarried. So when I was going to college to get my 2 years, I took a technical course, which made me a junior aircraft mechanic. So that was my backup plan. But while I was going to college, I took advantage of a government-subsidized program where I could get my private pilot's license. It cost $9.50 for a insurance policy for my parents and their written permission, by the way, to go fly with no commitment. And so I flew a Piper Cub, one of the early ones that had advertised 45 horsepower, and got my private pilot's license at age 19 in the spring of 1941. Then they hired our whole class, went to the Sacramento Air Depot, which was being built up. And they were hiring anybody that said they could turn a wrench. And we were on the graveyard shift most of the summer of 41. And I'd just gotten on days for about a month. And I remember it was Sunday, December 7th, the infamous attack on Pearl Harbor happened, and we were working 24/7, and I'd just gotten on days, and a foreman comes around and he says, "Hey, you, Bud Anderson, go home and come back at midnight. The Japs have just attacked us at Pearl Harbor." My God, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was.
Oh.
And I said, "Oh wow, we're going to go in. We're going to be in war." Well, a few days later, President Roosevelt did declare war on Japan and Germany, and I was still 19, but I was 20 the next month, January of in 42, and I went right to the recruiting station there on my birthday. And then a few days later, I was on my way off to military training. And I think that kind of tells you how I got into flying.
Well, it certainly does. And flight school at the time was probably a little compressed, but you learned how to fly in a variety of different airplanes, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I learned in a Piper Cub. And then in primary training, it was the Ryan PT-22, or PT-21, I guess, 22, open cockpit, no radio, low wing tail dragger. And then at basic flying school, we flew the BT-13, which had a radio at a canopy, and in a back seat where you could put the hood over you and fly instruments. And there we learned to fly formation, night flying, stuff like that. The airplane was still pretty basic. It was a tail dragger, had a two-position prop. Then from there, we went to Luke Field, Arizona, and flew the AT-6, which was much more powerful, had a retractable gear, and was a little more advanced than and a wonderful trainer.
Well, was it? when you were flying all these different planes, as we heard in the interview with Chuck Yeager, it's sort of like once you learn how to fly one of them, you can kind of pick up the controls and everything of another one. Is that the same case you found?
Oh, yeah. And as soon as you got more experience, the easier it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went into the P-39s in a replacement fighter pilot training group, and we actually this was Hamilton Field was our headquarters, but we were stationed at Oakland Municipal Airport, not even a military base, and flying the P-39s.
You know what's interesting about your whole story? We're talking with Bud Anderson and his book, and I highly recommend this to anybody who's interested in World War II aviation and just World War II veterans. Is called To Fly and Fight, and he talks a lot about what was going on during the very first year of the war in California, or as he just mentioned, he was at an airfield in Oakland, California. But most of the airfields were off the coastline because they were afraid that Japanese were going to invade. And I found that just to be fascinating that all of these things were going on at the same time. Most of us just don't have an understanding of what was happening during 1941, 42, and into 43. Bud flew, as I mentioned earlier, 116 combat missions, was a triple ace, 16 and a quarter enemy aircraft, highest scoring living American ace right now. And I'm very happy to have him on the program. I'm just excited. So I want to make sure that I have to get you over to Europe now. One of the things that I read in the book was you going over there on the Queen Elizabeth passenger liner. Could you talk about that just briefly?
Oh, yeah. We had trained as a fighter group. I got transferred. Instead of going overseas to a fighter group, I got transferred to the 357th, which was being activated for World War II. And so we were the first people in the unit. And that was great because that put me in a flight leader position. And Chuck Yeager came to our squadron. He was one of the first pilots to come in. We had, I think, a couple of classes of pilots came. And we trained and then finally went to Camp Shanks, New York, and at in the night, we boarded the Queen Elizabeth, yeah.
Right, Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, there was two of them, Queen Mary, Queen Elizabeth. They were sister ships, and they were the same size. Queen Mary was a lot more famous. And we boarded in the middle of the night in a dock, and you couldn't see the greatness of the ocean liner. And then the next afternoon we went out through the harbor of New York, blowing whistles and squirting water all over us in the fireboat. And I'm thinking all this time, Jesus, let's be quiet about this. Why don't we sneak out here at night so that German submarines won't find us? This was when we hadn't won the Battle of the Atlantic yet. We were still having our ships sunk by the German submarines. But I guess the ocean liners were so fast that it would be a lucky shot if a submarine happened to be in the right place at the right time to torpedo one. They flew. They went across back and forth across the ocean during the whole war and never were damaged.
I found that story to be really interesting to me because not only could the Queen Mary, I guess it was 25 knots, something like that, the submarine couldn't keep up with it, but also that there were, I mean, just thousands and thousands of soldiers and pilots and so forth on this Queen Mary. And, you know, it's a luxury liner, but, you know, you might have had a room, but there were 12 other people in there with you.
Yeah, they, we went over 15,000 troops.
Wow.
And I think it was a whole fighter group and then a bunch of infantry. And our GIs had to sleep in the, spend 24 hours in the hold of the ship and then 24 hours on the surface of the ship, on the top, out in the open. And I was a captain, just got promoted to captain. And so I had a honeymoon suite on the third deck with 17 other guys.
I just thought that was a great part of your story. You know, he's a captain. He's 21 years old. This is what this generation did. We have to take a real quick break, Bud, so I want you to hold on. Burnett, I want you to hold on as well. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back after these messages. We're talking with Bud Anderson, World War II fighter ace. His book is To Fly and Fight, and we will be back right after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Chaplain Joseph O'Callaghan administered to the wounded and dying, led firefighting crews, and directed the jettisoning of live ammunition from his stricken ship. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
O'Callaghan was serving as chaplain on board the USS Franklin when that vessel was fiercely attacked by enemy Japanese aircraft. Calmly braving the barriers of fire and twisted metal to aid his men and his ship, O'Callaghan groped his way through smoke-filled quarters to the open flight deck and into the midst of violently exploding bombs, shells, rockets, and other armament. With the ship rocked by incessant explosions, with debris and fragments raining down and fires raging in ever-increasing fury, he ministered to the wounded and dying, comforting and encouraging men of all faiths. He organized and led firefighting crews into the blazing inferno on the flight deck. He directed the jettisoning of live ammunition and the flooding of the magazine. He manned a hose to cool hot armed bombs rolling dangerously on the listing deck, continuing his efforts despite searing, suffocating smoke which forced men to fall back gasping. O'Callaghan inspired the officers and men of the Franklin to fight heroically and with profound faith in the face of almost certain death and to return their stricken ship to port.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Okay, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and I just wanted to remind everybody that our Medal of Honor segment this week was sponsored by the Fretz Family Foundation in honor of Major Kevin Knave, United States Marine Corps. If you'd like to sponsor a Medal of Honor segment, please go to the Veterans Radio website, veteransradio.net, and /Medal of Honor, and we'll be happy to do that for you. We're talking with Bud Anderson, who was a World War II fighter ace, three-time triple ace in World War II, shot down 16 and one quarter aircraft, German aircraft, and including a couple on the ground. Bud, now that you've arrived in England and you've got your own aircraft, could you kind of describe your first mission over Germany for us?
Well, let's see. My very first mission, a little bit of humorous. Being a flight leader, they had the squadron commander, ops officers, and the flight leaders. We went down to the 354th group, which was a 9th Air Force fighter group that had been was on loan to the 8th Air Force, and they've been so wildly successful that the 8th Air Force demanded that they get P-51s, and we're the next unit to have P-51s, so we went to the 8th Air Force. So to get a little combat experience, we went down to the 354th and flew a combat mission with them. So we go down there, we take our own airplanes down and land at their base and spend the night and then get the briefing. And I'm hoping that we get a little milk run over into France and back. But no, it was a full-fledged mission to, I think it was Leipzig. Pretty deep in Germany anyway, and more than likely we're going to see enemy airplanes. So I'm a wingman with a guy who's already shot down a couple of airplanes, and one of my classmates, and so we're flying along. The thing you don't want to do is get lost at any time over Germany by yourself. And so you hang on to your leader pretty darn good. So I'm flying along there, number two, and suddenly they say something about enemy airplanes. And then all of a sudden, my leader and I are upside down, looking up down through the canopy. Upside down, and I see this Focke-Wulf 190, beautiful airplane, kind of a robin's egg blue and big black crosses on it. Man, it looked like the enemy. And so my leader is rolling over and trying to get in position to take a shot at him, and we're kind of far back. And so, man, I'm hanging on. Boy, I'm not going to get lost. So I've kind of slid back a little bit. And then all of a sudden, somebody screamed on the radio, "Mustang, Mustang, there's one on your tail." You know, not, "Hey, Red 2, you know, somebody's on your tail." It was just Mustang. Well, Christ, there was 16 plus, maybe more than that, Mustangs in the area. So my leader kind of wiggles around looking back, I'm hanging on with him, and pretty soon he straightens out and goes after him again, and came to the voice again, "Mustang, Mustang, he's still on your tail." Jesus. God, I thought maybe it's me, you know. So I'm trying to look back and everything, and then all of a sudden my leader takes violent, evasive action. He thought the
they were talking about him. So we're going down like crazy, and pretty soon, he sure enough, he lost me all right. And there I am over Germany all by myself. The thing you don't want to happen to you.
No, you certainly wouldn't want to do that. In your book, to Fly and Fight, you describe that incident as some of the aircraft, or some of the German aircraft, looked similar to your P-51s. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. 51s look like 109s, and P-47s look somewhat like a 190.
Well, you were really a fortunate pilot, I think. And again, in reading your book, you never took a hit from from an enemy aircraft.
That's true.
Holy, that's amazing. That's a true testament to your flying ability. That's for darn sure. One of the things that I read about you and Jaeger was that your vision was 20/10. What does that mean?
Well, 20/20 is normal for good vision, and that's the requirement to get in the service. And both of us had 20/10. In our eyes were better than normal. Yeah.
And that's because, and you guys could pick up targets well before many, many members of your flights.
That's true.
I remember that because as a pilot myself, I used to be able to see around corners, it seemed like, or I could read a sign way down the highway that nobody else could see. But unfortunately, that hasn't remained.
Yeah.
So you flew all these missions, and we're coming up on running out of time already. You flew all of these missions and came home safely, which I think is great. Your aircraft was christened it as Old Crow, correct?
Yes. You want to know why?
I want our audience to know why. I know why.
Well, I tell my non-drinking friends it's named after the most intelligent bird that flies in the sky, the crow. And that's true. The crow is a very, very canny bird. But my drinking buddies all know it's named after that good old straight bourbon whiskey, Old Crow brand.
I wanted to get that out. I also want to let people know that your original aircraft has been refurbished and everything, actually by somebody here in Michigan, Jack Roush, was able to get hold of your original Old Crow and has refurbished it. And I guess he's flying it around, or I don't know if he is, but flying it around at air shows and so forth. Is that true?
It's not the actual airplane.
Okay.
But it's a real P-51 that he's painted it up like my airplane. And he did two of them. He did a D and also a B model. And he sold the D to Jim Hagedorn.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in addition, I want our audience to understand is that, you know, at the end of World War II, when you came home, safely came home, after shooting down your 16-and-a-quarter aircraft, you were promoted to a major, and you were all of 22 years old, and you stayed into the service up until 1972, and you actually did a tour of combat in Vietnam as a jet pilot.
That's true. I commanded the F-105 wing of F-105 Thunder Chiefs.
Well, I just admire you so much, and I wanted our audience to at least get an introduction to you. You can go to Bud has his own website at cebudanderson.com, and I encourage you to buy that book. We've only got about a minute left, so Bernadette, I wanted to thank you very much again. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to get you to ask any questions, but thank you for introducing me to this amazing man.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Bud, thank you. I hope we can get you back on for a longer conversation at some time in the near future.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Stories.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Colonel Clarence E. Bud Anderson, the last surviving ace, highest scoring living American ace pilot here from the United States Army Air Corps, now the Air Force. So I wanted to thank them for being on the program, and I encourage everybody to do that. We're going to try and put on a program next week for benefits at the end of the year, so hopefully you will tune in. I want to thank everybody for tuning into Veterans Radio. We really appreciate it. We really appreciate your support, and we could use it more and more as we go into the 2021, if we can believe that one. And I want to thank everybody for listening. Please go to veteransradio.net. Check out our merchandise. We've got sweatshirts and hats and all kinds of different paraphernalia for you. And go to, you can purchase Bud's book, To Fly and Fight, on Amazon.com. And until next week, this is Dale Thornberry wishing everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. You are dismissed.